Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Media Project is underway. It's an opportunity for some commentary and analysis, and some days when we're really on our game, some insight into the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, the editor of the Times Union, here with my co-host, Dr. Alan Chartoff.
I wouldn't go as far to say co-host.
Oh,
I'm your subordinate.
That's right. Just the little guy in the room. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that.
I'm so sorry.
Dr. Chartoff is the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Judy Patrick is here, vice president of the New York Press Association, former editor of the Daily Gazette.
I am grateful to be here this morning.
We are so grateful.
I'm grateful to be here any time of the day.
Any day, any evening, or whatever it might be.
Thank you.
And Jim Heaney is here, whom you all have not met, you listeners. Jim Heaney is the founder and editor of Investigative Post, based out in Buffalo. Jim, how are you?
I'm still trying to wake up.
So that's a good thing. So, you know, we ought to explain to people what Investigative Post is, because in the areas where this show is heard, folks don't know of it.
We are a nonprofit investigative reporting center based out of Buffalo. We do mostly Buffalo, Western New York-based stories, but some of our reporting has made its way to this end of the state. We broke a lot of the major stories involving the Buffalo Billion scandal, and which has got some Albany people headed towards state prison.
How about that?
Or maybe federal prison.
Federal prison.
Mm-hmm. I was a reporter at the Buffalo News for 25 years, started Investigative Post 7 years ago. We've got a full-time reporting staff of three folks. We do work for WGRZ, the NBC affiliate in Buffalo, WBFO, the NPR affiliate in Buffalo. We were on the Capitol Press Room with Susan moving on, Susan Arbetter. I'm not sure where that relationship is right now. And Spree Magazine, which is the city magazine for Buffalo. So
Spree.
So
Spree,
who pays Buffalo for all of that?
Combination of payments from our content partners, primarily WGRZ, foundations, major donors, which we define as $1,000 or more. Between foundations and major donors, we've got about 35-40 folks, and then we've got a membership base, smaller donors of 300 or 400.
So I wanted to ask you a very quick question. Is Buffalo in Ohio, or is it in New York City?
Are we in Albany, Vermont right now? I don't know.
Exactly. And Dr. Chartoff here is not a resident of New York State, so he's one of those those Easterners, those folks that the Trumpists decry.
As the boxing referee today, I give that blow to Rex. Keep the score. At the end of the show, I'll tell you who won this match.
Mario used to say to me, you sneak across the line with a black cloak on you, and you earn your money in New York, and then you sneak back and spend it in Massachusetts.
It's interesting. So you're operating as a not-for-profit.
Yeah.
Big news this week, and big news in our little corner of the world, is that a for-profit enterprise, a newspaper serving a major city, the Salt Lake Tribune, has gone from for-profit to not-for-profit.
I've got some pretty strong feelings about it. I think it's a placebo. I think the newspaper industry has a problem, and it's not its tax status, it's its business model. And I think any major daily that's losing money that thinks it's going to save itself by going nonprofit is fooling itself.
Well, I don't know, not to give you too hard a time.
Except that that's what he likes to do.
Especially
so go
a
ahead.
Guy whose name rhymes with me. my question to you would be, why not? In other words, we just had a fund drive. It was one day. We may raise $1 million. Why can't a good newspaper source do the same thing?
I think you can raise money, but the overhead for a typical large metro is in the Well,
many millions.
Yeah, yeah, tens of millions.
And then there's a profit that has to go to the publisher.
Yeah, and the problem is you might raise $1 million or $2 million a year nonprofit-wise if you're a big daily, and odds are that you're losing more money than that. It's just what ails the daily newspaper industry is not going to be saved through charitable contributions.
So what ails it? What do you think we need to deal with?
Oh, I think the daily newspaper industry is terminal.
Huh.
Well, Rex agrees with you. As a matter of fact, the answer to your question, your very good question, Rex, as usual, is kiss your butt goodbye because it's over.
Let's talk about the nonprofit status for some of the small local papers, the dailies and the weeklies. I don't think that's going to work in a really small community because it doesn't have the base to create that much nonprofit revenue. And the other issue with nonprofit status is that nonprofits are run by board of directors. And often in a small community, the people on the board of directors are going to be people who may not want you to write a story about their particular business. So there's that issue of control as well. Nonprofits come in and rescue us once in a while with a grant to provide reporting on a particular issue, but it doesn't really deal with this business model. But I do not think daily newspapers are terminal. I think they do have a future.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. I think it's the paper that's terminal. That is the newsprint, but not the major news organizations.
I agree with you.
Yeah, right. I think that's right.
I hate to do that.
But the problem is I see it, and I work in daily newspapers for 31 years. I don't see daily newspapers, for the most part, changing the way they report and present the news. It's still, newspapers write newspaper stories, and sometimes they're in print, and sometimes they're online. But the digital world is, it's video, it's audio. When you look at the studies, the percentage of young people who prefer their news in print, I just saw some numbers the other day, it's like 5%.
Right.
Really? Because we took this out on last week's show. Judy and Rex were making the point that, there are more and more young people. I disagreed, by the way. More and more people we have in the studio with us, the honored professors. But when I ask my students how many people read a newspaper every day, it's a very disappointing.
I think what newspapers should be doing is becoming multimedia news organizations, not print/online only, because, people get their news primarily through television. And I know my hometown paper, the former paper I work for, they're not producing video. Is the Times Union producing much by way of video?
There are two answers to that. I mean, there are multiple answers to what you're saying here. There has not been newspapers that have dropped video as a must deliver for all their news stories have failed. That is a solution, I'm sorry, from 10 years ago. There were producers all over the country saying, like at Newsday down in Long Island, I remember the executive producer down there saying, we're going to put video with all of our stories. That has not proven to be a good formula. What does work is, yes, some little video, some bits of video, but not the kinds of video that TV stations do, 90-second packages on individual stories. You want to have sprinkled bits of video, and actually I am right now in the process of hiring 5 new digital staffers, including a video lead producer, video and audio, so that we can do more podcasts and video. I do think that's a part of the formula.
You're probably ahead of the curve.
We're probably more progressive than the Buffalo News, yes.
The bottom line is the revenue, as you know. Revenue is going away. It's not coming back.
The American public has always primarily consumed its news from television. That's nothing new. That happened in the 60s and 70s. Before then, it was radio. And radio still is a dominant source of news. But, to be quite honest, the radio and TV people are getting their news from the local newspaper that gets delivered to their studios. Not all radio stations, but a lot of TV and radio.
It's a point well worth making, and Rex makes it a great deal. Mm. You guys are relying on us. Use our stuff. And you're making all the money.
Well, yeah, we're not all the money. We're not poor. It's just that it is going away. And that's why it so annoys us. We had a TV station in this market, in the Albany market, that absolutely swiped word for word some of our enterprise reporting, and stuff that the reporter had really had to dig out, and so the reporter got ticked off and tweeted about it. And it went on for days before the TV station finally called me and apologized and said, well, we've dealt with this internally. But they never linked back to our original story. You know, it's...
I mean, as a newspaper reporter for over 30 years, that's happened to me. And you do the slow burn over it, or the not-so-slow burn over
it. Yeah, not-so-slow. We now are calling news directors. We're embarrassing them publicly with Twitter so that people know that they're stealing copyrighted content. All the time.
They should always attribute it,
at least. And actually, the code of ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists now says you should link to the original story. That's really the fair thing to do.
The Society for Professional Journalists has a code of ethics?
You know, but I think the idea that young people aren't reading, I think, is wrong. I think that they are consuming news. It's not necessarily that they're picking up a print newspaper, but I think they are going to websites and reading content.
I think they don't all need to get fed,
you know, spoon-fed to them in a tweet or in a TikTok clip.
And yet you can't get away from the fact, and we hear from Rex a great deal about this, that NPR stations are increasing staff, have more and more people, and, you know, the newspapers have to lay people off all the time now, and it's very sad to watch.
Yeah, it actually is an interesting story that public radio stations are hiring. Nancy Barnes, who took over NPR News, what was that, a year ago? She said, I think we can add 1,000 local news jobs in the next few years, maybe 2,000. It has been between 2011 and 2018, the 264 independent NPR stations added 1,000 full-time and part-time journalists. How about that? Started out with just 2,000. Now, that's still by scale is very small. If they've added 1,000 full-time, the newspaper industry has shed 30,000.
Yeah.
So that's painful. But it is growing, which is a really good thing. And
but the real question, I guess, Rex, is how much independent journalism do NPR stations, for example, do? I mean, we have 8 bureau chiefs out there. They do their thing, and they bring in material that may not always comes from a newspaper. They may have to do enterprise themselves, and that's very different from a news station, you know, in Albany, New York, reading directly from your copy.
Absolutely, and I think you saw this. I mean, to your credit, Alan, you made this happen at WAMC a long time ago, setting up these news bureaus all over the region that you cover, as opposed to some of the stations that are NPR affiliates that have filled their airwaves entirely with the stuff that comes from NPR.
You are absolutely right.
Let's record that moment.
Well, you are absolutely right. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is people give you money and they expect that money to be used in a productive and journalistic fashion. And if you don't do that, then, you know, you're deficient.
And people out there should realize that when it comes to writing stories, to doing investigative stories, even producing a story on the radio, it lasts 30 seconds or a minute and a half, but it takes an enormous amount of time in the background to do investigative stories, to do stories on the radio. I talked to a doctor at one point, and I explained what I did for a living, and he says, does that take, you know, 5 days a week? And so he had no comprehension that it's time-consuming to produce the news. Investigative stories, you have to wait forever for information to come in. You go down blind alleys all the time, or rabbit holes.
Yeah, and to Jim's point, the delivery of the news by each medium has to be diversified, I think. Now, NPR stations are putting out newsletters, digital newsletters. So that's more like what we do. We write stories and put it out all the time. If you listen to WAMC, they say more information is available at WAMC.org. And so they're sending people to the website to get deeper stuff. And in some instances, there are great partnerships. The state of Kentucky, for example, has this great investigative newsroom that is run by the NPR affiliate in Lexington, I believe.
Which may be why they have a Democratic governor coming in.
Well, I wouldn't be at all surprised that the investigative reporting by that newsroom was a key part of uncovering some of Governor Bevin's, though he's pretty blatant. He, I don't know, it took a lot of digging to get met.
it just floated to the surface.
Yeah. You know, there is some advantage to not-for-profit, right? Like at the Salt Lake Tribune, which, by the way, has been owned by the Huntsman family, as in John Huntsman, the ambassador, the former governor. I mean, they're a major political family. And one of the interesting things about not-for-profit status is they can no longer have an editorial page that makes political endorsements. Mm-hmm. Columnists can, but they have to be very careful about doing political endorsements. But nonprofit enables them to just diversify their revenue streams. They can get donations, as you said, and philanthropic contributions, while at the same time they can make money off advertising and what we still call subscriptions, what Alan would refer to as a membership.
Another concern I've got with daily for-profits getting into the nonprofit is money is tough to come by for real nonprofits, folks like me. It's tough to come by in the community. It's tough to come by through national foundations. And when these dailies jump in, they're going to be the 900-pound gorilla. Mm. And they are going to compete with a sector that's growing but suffering from lack of funding. So you're going to have – it's going to hurt the growth of the nonprofit news sector as we see it now, because there's going to be less money available. And that, to me, is very concerning, because the nonprofit sector is the one sector that's actually growing. Some of the national foundations love to chase the shiny new toy, and this will be the shiny new toy. You know, the shiny new toy last year was fake news, and you saw a lot of funding to study fake news. Rather than helping news organizations produce real news, they like to study.
I'd like to just ask you a question, since we have you, and it's so rare that you're over this end of the good side of the state.
What state are we in again?
So I just wanted to ask you about the wonderful work you guys have done on the Buffalo Billions. That was a major news story that you did. I'm astounded that two of the people closest to the governor, as you mentioned before, have gone to jail. Three actually are going. And yet, the consequences for the Cuomo administration don't seem to be very great, do they?
No, and it should have been. Based on what I know, or what I think I know, Cuomo could have easily been indicted himself. And the failure of the U.S. Attorney's
Pete
office.
Ferrara.
Yeah. Well, no, he was gone.
No. Pete Ferrara was
he
still
started
the U.S.
It,
attorney.
And,
yeah.
But when those cases were actually being prosecuted.
Yes, that's right.
He was already into his podcasting career. And I firmly believe Cuomo is known as a control freak. Did this really go on without him knowing? I find that very, very hard to believe. And there's a pattern here. We did a story a couple weeks ago about plans to build data centers in central and western New York, which typically involve huge public subsidies, few jobs, little, if any, spin-off development. And what's the company that he's dealing with? Well, the company's government relations guy is his former secretary and chairman of his last campaign committee when he ran for governor a couple of years ago.
So, but I guess
that's a coincidence. That's a coincidence.
Huh? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Right. And once again, much like, you know, the Buffalo Billions story really didn't start out about corruption. It started out about a lack of transparency about what they were doing, and that led to other things. I don't see where Andrew Cuomo has learned anything from that, because they're now doing the same thing in Lansing and in Somerset.
You make great use of the Freedom of Information Law, I presume.
Yeah.
Digging out, you know, it's interesting. I'm on a panel that is of the state. Judy and I actually are media advisors to a panel of the State Bar Association looking at how the legal profession might support the First Amendment. And one of the things that is now
they can
addressed,
start by stop charging $300 or $400 an hour to pursue.
That's exactly right. Legal
cases.
Clinics, legal clinics to provide support for mm-hmm. media. Small not-for-profits like yours, smaller newspapers across the country. The editor of the Auburn Citizen, Jeremy Boyer, testifying in Syracuse a couple of weeks ago, made the point that to pursue a Freedom of Information piece of work as a plaintiff through one round would cost him about half a reporter's annual salary.
You're talking Article 78,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we know that there is resistance on the national level. The Freedom of Information Law, the Justice Department turned down an effort by BuzzFeed and
CNN, I think.
CNN, yes, trying to get documents that underlie the Attorney General, William Barr's assertion that the, remember his initial summary of what came out of the Mueller investigation. So these reporters are trying to find out, so what are the, let us see the documents that led to the Attorney General's summary that said that basically nothing was done wrong. And the Justice Department has, they said, well, that'll take, that'll be a billion documents. We can't give that to you. So a federal judge has just ordered the Justice Department to hand the news organizations 500 pages per month, which could keep it busy for the next 8 years.
Yeah. But, well, you know, I think in New York State in particular, under Andrew Cuomo, the FOI law is being used to thwart the release of information. I've never been...
What do you mean by that? I'm sorry.
Well, back in the day, if you wanted a document, you could ask for it, and sometimes they wanted an FOI, and sometimes they just wanted clarity on what you wanted, and they'd hand it to you.
Back in the day, you could talk to people.
Yeah,
yeah, that
knew,
too.
Knew
yeah.
what was going on.
And, what do you mean, Judy? I'm sorry.
You could, if you went to a hazardous waste spill, for example, you could go and talk to the engineer on site, and he would tell you what was going on. Now you have to talk to a PR official who will talk to the engineer and get back to you. So it's
eventually.
You could talk to state agencies. You could call up the general counsel and talk about the law underlying something, or a deputy commissioner, or get the or go into the office and chat with a commissioner. You can't do that in this
state
anymore.
Those were the glory days.
Yeah. Well, how much does leadership of our FOI group count for? So, for example, we had this legendary figure, Bob Freeman, who was extolled by the reportorial and other editorial communities, and then ran into a little bit of a rough patch himself. Do we know if, in fact, that change in leadership has changed the way in which we look at this?
Bob Freeman headed an office of the Secretary of State's called the Committee on Open Government. That is an office at its height. It was Bob and another lawyer and an administrative assistant, and now it's just the other lawyer and the administrative assistant, and they only have advisory powers. In other states, in New Jersey, in Rhode Island, in Washington, Oregon, there are laws that give more teeth. The Freedom of Information laws, state laws in those states actually also have tighter deadlines. The way that the New York FOIL is constructed allows basically constructive denial. It allows them to string us along. I think that's Jim's point
very,
here,
very
right?
Very interesting. And yet, when Bob Freeman used to utter an opinion, it counted for something.
It depended who was in charge. I find it, in my neck of the woods, with Buffalo, with the city of Buffalo, whose mayor is also very hostile to the concept of the public's right to know. Now, automatically, I need a FOIL request from you. Mm-hmm. And then they'll wait the full five. Under the law, you've got 5 days to acknowledge. They'll wait till the fifth day before they acknowledge. And they almost, in our case anyways, and Rex, I'm sure it's the case, you don't get it after 5 days. You get a letter saying, well, we need more time. We'll be getting back to you.
Okay, so what's the fix? Is the fix legislative?
Could be, yes. There are a couple of fixes that I think are worth pushing. Let me just say, though, that I think it's not all legislative. I think what you're asking isn't leadership an important part of it? Doesn't?
Yes. Okay, we got that.
Yep, you're right. I mean, in the sense that if a governor said, my administration is going to be transparent, and truly was, if people were told, you know,
this governor we're going to do that. Which he wasn't.
And he isn't. Yeah. But
yes. Also, school board presidents, mayors,
county
executives, it's every leadership. I mean, this isn't just the governor. This is all
over
the state.
Well, not only the governor. We're also talking about whoever's leading the Freedom of Information Agency, basically.
But I think legally the state could enforce, could change the law so that the legal opinions of the office, if, for example, in Rhode Island, if you are denied a document under FOIL, you can automatically appeal to the Attorney General's office, which can order the release of documents.
So
we have no such thing in this state.
So, Rexy, leading to the question then, how come the legislature doesn't make it tougher?
There you go.
The legislature that has exempted itself from some provisions
there
of
you
the
go.
FOI?
There you go. And they will not do it because local officials don't want to have to, you know, they would be lobbied against it by the Council of Mayors, by the Association of County Executives, by the governor. You know, there's very little. Some legislators stand up on this issue. We have some New York State legislators who want to sponsor and who do every year sponsor improvements, but by and large, it's not going to get out.
Yeah, the culture during my 35, 40 years as a reporter has changed. Not that government was always thrilled with the prospect of sharing information, but there is a real contempt now for the public's right to know. Politicians treat public information as though it's their information to release when it suits their purposes. And it's getting worse and worse and worse. And it's going to require a sea change because it's hand-to-hand combat now when you want to get information sometimes.
Are you discouraged?
No, it's just a fact of life.
You know, the thing is, it discourages a lot of young journalists who think that they're going to file this FOIL and magically they're going to get the information they want. And a year goes by and they've moved to another job. And, you know, it's very discouraging because they think it's going to work and it doesn't. And again and again and again, it doesn't. What we heard at the forum in Syracuse a week or two ago was the fact that journalists think this thing is irreversibly broken and needs a whole rewrite.
But the impetus for that is what? You know, the impetus for freedom of information laws was Watergate, really, mm-hmm. which changed the public mood, which awakened Americans to the value of transparency. We need to dig stuff out that government is hiding. I don't know that there is any similar push that could
come.
Not
Trump?
Yeah, just the opposite with Trump. He brands us as the enemy of the people.
Yeah, to Rex's point, I think there has to be some outrage that he is saying, no, you get nothing.
I don't know that there's outrage. I haven't seen the outrage that would be raised. There's a little bit. I mean, yes, you're right. The New York Times and the Washington Post in their ad campaigns, clearly their ad agencies believe that there is mileage in selling the idea of a free press being important. You see the ads that they play during football games and stuff.
Yeah, Super Bowl.
Yeah, how about that? So maybe there is, they at least see that there's some kind of an audience there that appreciates the idea of freedom of information, but I don't know that it's broad enough for it to actually lead to legislation.
Yeah, no, I think it's incumbent on the press to be persistent, and this is a fact of life that we have to deal with, and we can't quit. We have no choice but to persist.
So that is Jim Heaney, and that is the end of the show.
I just want to say one more thing, and that is
I bet you do.
We still need more deep throats. I mean, I think that's the issue. Some sources.
All right. Alan Shartok, Jim Heaney of the Investigative Post, Judy Patrick of the New York Press Association, and I'm Rex Smith from the Times Union. Thanks for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Tingling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.